Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Monday, February 15th, 2016. I'm Michael Brooks, pinch hitting for Sam Cedar, and this is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Benjamin Dixon, the host of the Benjamin Dixon Show, will discuss Bernie Sanders and the African-American vote, injecting class into American politics, and we will review the Republican debate train wreck, which has Matt giddy. I've actually never seen Matt this happy.
It's true.
It's true. And it's tremendous. He really did a fantastic job with it. We'll also talk about the fraudulent intellectual legacy of Justice Antonin Scalia, why originalism is intellectually incoherent, and just another pseudo-historical fraud brought to you by the Kochs and the Bradleys and all the other troubled old white men trying to impede progress in this country and succeeding in many ways. That is all part of Justice Scalia's legal legacy. I have no comments on him as a person. He seemed like a nice guy. I enjoyed him in Goodfellas as Paulie. Someone tweeted that, and that was my favorite joke of the weekend. Quick heads up, we will discuss Justice Scalia on the fun half. Sam did an interview just this morning with Ian Millhiser of Think Progress, where they went into detail, less so actually on the legacy of Justice Scalia, more just on the implications now of this sudden death. Can Obama get somebody appointed? How does it fit? Cases that are in question right now, all of those sort of urgent questions that arise out of Scalia's death. That show will be released today as a separate standalone show. So for both the public and for members, you're going to get my conversation with Benjamin Dixon, and you're going to get Sam's conversation with Ian Millhiser. And I believe we're going to have no show tomorrow, which is the first day of our vacation.
That is correct. The Millhiser is going to substitute for
the Millhiser will substitute for the new show we had planned for tomorrow. So there will be two shows today. We will discuss some of the Scalia legacy on the fun half and the bigger questions about what's in play now will be addressed in the Sam and Ian Millhiser interview. And also on the fun half, we will get to some new news out of Syria. NBA All-Star Game was happening this past weekend, and there's a celebrity component to it because there's always this desperation to juke up and make these things relevant. I remember there didn't always used to be all these bells and whistles with NBA All-Star Games, but now there are. And the dude from Arcade Fire, the lead singer, whose name I always forget, as in literally I just knew it 30 seconds ago and I've forgotten it again.
Win Butler,
sorry guys. He was there, and ESPN cut to him. And the irony of this is that ESPN does these amazing 30 for 30 documentaries. Like, I just watched one over the weekend on the Big Ten and the 1980s, which was awesome. And these documentaries actually deal with sports and culture and politics and race and fashion. They're awesome. But I guess Win Butler, taking his moment at the NBA All-Star Game to talk about something other than the other celebrities he was playing with or slam dunks, made everybody over at ESPN very uncomfortable. So let's take a listen.
Congratulations.
Thank you. I just want to say, as an election year in the U.S., the U.S. has a lot they can learn from Canada. Healthcare, taking care of people.
And so we're talking about celebrity stuff, not politics. Congratulations on your MVP.
Awkward.
That is 15 seconds that has so much of my favorite things. You got basketball, you've got socialized medicine, you've got uncomfortable media, you've got Win Butler. It's the greatest thing in the world. I love that.
So there you have it, folks. We needed to do that up front because that's one of Matt's favorite things in the world. You should say that in Mike Kelly.
It's so weird. No, and, yeah. And I love all of Matt's weird quirks. So it's adorably weird.
We all love Matt's eccentricities, including his commitment to West Indian medicine. I'm just messing with you. Folks, I'm unshaven. I have not had time to shave, which is insane. And it was basically too cold this past weekend to do anything, including shave. That's how horrifying it was. And last year at this time, I was in Trinidad doing carnival, and I didn't have time to shave either. And what's really annoying is that after you have grown your beard out, and there's something satisfying about it, because if you're a man, you like to know that you can actually grow a full beard, and you know, it's kind of validating on some level. But you need to clean it up. It's my mom's birthday this week. I'm going to go home and see my mom. She doesn't like this hipster Brooklyn neo-Marxist nonsense. She likes a clean shave. I guess being a mama's boy, though not in the Jeb Bush way, I will shave to make my mom happy. And I'll be using my Harry's razor. These razors are unbelievable. They give you such a good shave. They're incredibly affordable, and they're just a no-brainer. And so, I was thinking to myself the other day, when did shaving get so incredibly expensive? Okay, and this is true. I would go to Duane Reade here in New York City, and I would buy a pack of these, like, Quattro, Watro, Blatro, like, triple blade, all this nonsense, like you're planning, like, some type of invasion on your face. And I would spend serious money to shave. It was nonsense. And basically, as soon as I got Harry's, okay, better shave, totally inexpensive. And they look really good, and they last a really long time. It's kind of incredible. And I've had the best shave in a long time, except, you know, I've been shaving with Harry's for a while. I don't use anything else now. Harry's blades are super, super sharp, and they provide a close, comfortable shave. Harry's is the only shaving company that has both amazing quality and low prices. German-engineered 5-blade cartridges, close, comfortable shave, no cuts or burn. That's absolutely true. Quality guaranteed, and a full refund if you're not happy. Factory direct prices cut out the middlemen and shipped right to your door. They sell their blades at half price over to leading brands. It's true. I mean, again, you go into any drugstore and the amount that you spend on any halfway decent razor is insane. And then you got to go get like the thing unlocked and you got to deal with all this nonsense. Proof over 1 million guys have already made the shift. I'm sure a lot of women have made the shift as well. And thousands more make the switch every day. Why pay $32 for an 8-pack of blades when you can get them for half the price at Harrys.com? The Harry's starter set is an amazing deal. For just $15, you get a razor, moisturizer, shave cream, and 3 razor blades. That's a no-brainer. Harry's doesn't like to give discounts because their prices are already really low. But we've worked out a special offer for you guys. Harry will give you $5 off your first order with promo code MAJORITYREPORT. Stop overpaying for a great shave. Go to Harry's right now. That's harrys.com, harrys.com. Enter promo code MAJORITY at checkout. That's promo code MAJORITY at checkout. Get an amazing shave at half the price. We'll be right back with Benjamin Dixon on the Majority Report.
fire
Welcome back to the Majority Report. I'm Michael Brooks. Joining us now is Benjamin Dixon. He is the host of the Benjamin Dixon Show, which everybody can find on YouTube at Benjamin Dixon Show, as well as on his website. We have a link to it on our homepage. Benjamin, how you doing?
I'm doing great, Michael. Thanks so much for having me today.
It's a pleasure to be talking with you. So obviously a lot of big news over this past weekend. We have a separate show coming out on the death of Justice Scalia. I'll get to some of that in the fun half. But the other thing that sort of shouldn't be lost in the shock of that event and the response to it by the Republicans, which is, it's not mind-blowing by their standards, but it's still kind of stunning. We shouldn't lose awareness of the fact that the Republican debate in South Carolina happened mere hours after the death of Justice Scalia was announced. Mm-hmm. They basically treated his death almost with less respect than people like you or I did by proceeding to go out and have this sort of like debacle in South Carolina. We got some sound from it. But before we get to that, I want to get your sort of aerial view. What's your snapshot impression of that debate?
You know, my first impression is that the smaller it gets, the crazier it's going to get.
Right.
It was a free-for-all. The most amazing thing was that the more Donald Trump said something that was salient and cogent and true, the more the audience booed him.
Right.
So that was quite hilarious to me.
Yeah, no, in fact, let's get to that, actually, because I don't think anybody would have predicted that the most blunt description of George W. Bush's Iraq record would be articulated by the Republican frontrunner in South Carolina at a debate. I don't think maybe there's some $10 psychic on 23rd Street that I haven't talked to that would have predicted that. But certainly no one I know, and I don't think you or I. So let's play this exchange. Trump is talking about George W. Bush taking us into Iraq, and you know Jeb is sort of kind of blubbering off in the corner, and Trump is making the case. Let's listen to that.
A close quote. When you were asked what you meant by that, you said for the war. He lied. He got us into the war with lies. Do you still believe President Bush should have been impeached?
First of all, I have to say, as a businessman, I get along with everybody. I have business all over the world. I know so many of the people in the audience. And by the way, I'm a self-funder. I don't have. I have my wife and I have my son. That's all I have.
Don't forget your daughter.
So let me just tell you, I get along with everybody, which is my obligation to my company, to myself, etc. Obviously, the war in Iraq was a big, fat mistake. All right? Now, you can take it any way you want. And it took Jeb Bush, if you remember, at the beginning of his announcement, when he announced for president, took him 5 days. He went back. It was a mistake. It wasn't a mistake. Took him 5 days before his people told him what to say. And he ultimately said, it was a mistake. The war in Iraq, we spent $2 trillion, thousands of lives. We don't even have it. Iran is taking over Iraq with the second largest oil reserves in the world. Obviously, it was a mistake.
So
George Bush made a mistake. We can make mistakes, but that one was a beauty. We should have never been in Iraq. We have destabilized the Middle East.
But you still think he should be impeached?
I think it's my turn, isn't it?
You do whatever you want. You call it whatever you want. Jesus. I want to tell you, they lied.
Okay.
They said there were weapons of mass destruction. There were none, and they knew there were none. There were no weapons of mass destruction.
Okay, all right. Governor Bush. When a member on the stage's brother gets attacked, the brother gets
five
to respond.
Or six. Do I get to do it five or six times or just once? So here's the deal.
Here's the deal.
I'm sick and tired of Barack Obama blaming my brother for all of the problems that he's had. And frankly, I could care less about the insults that Donald Trump gives to me.
Mm.
It's blood sport for him. He enjoys it, and I'm glad he's happy about it.
Mm. But I am sick and tired
of him going after my family. My dad is the greatest man alive in my mind. And while Donald Trump was
Jesus
building
Christ.
A reality TV show, my
so
brother
creepy.
Was building a security apparatus to keep us safe, and I'm proud of what he did. And he's had the gall to go
the
after
World
my
Trade
mother.
Center came
he's
down
had
during
the gall
your brother's
to go after
reign.
My
Remember
mother.
That.
Hold
yes.
On. Let me finish this.
Yes.
Had the gall to go after my mother.
That's not keeping
Look, I won
safe.
The lottery when I was born 63 years ago.
Oh,
looked
God.
Up and I saw my mom. My mom is the strongest woman I know.
She should
this
be running.
This is not about my family or his family.
Okay.
This is about the South Carolina families that need someone to be a commander-in-chief that can lead.
Governor,
I'm that person.
Governor.
All right. I mean, I don't even. That's just sort of a thing of beauty. Let's leave the obvious mommy and daddy issues aside. We'll probably get to those in the fun half. What do you make of that?
Yeah. Man, it was it was pure entertainment. But the first thing that jumps out legitimately is that that audience was so stacked. That audience was so, it was not a random pool of
right.
voters, because a random pool of voters actually would have agreed with Donald Trump's assessment of Iraq, right? You could tell, I knew from the moment they introduced Ben Carson and then they introduced Marco Rubio, the crowd went wild over Marco Rubio, notwithstanding his ridiculous performance in the last debate. So what you saw there was the same special interest crowd audience supporting Jeb Bush on weak policies, on weak statements, turn around booing Donald Trump for things that were accurate. This was the most amazing thing to me of all. There were no weapons of mass destruction. You know, we got into it based on a lie. These are actual truths that we know at this point, yet this is something that they want to boo. Are we just dismissing the truth because it's inconvenient?
Yes.
Or are we booing Donald Trump because we have a strategy to pull him down from the front runner on the Republican side?
Yeah, and I guess the follow-up for that I think is really important, I'd like your thoughts on too. We've sort of had the position for a long time that the support for Donald Trump is attitudinal and dispositional, so that every time people say, you know, oh my God, now, you know, Ted Cruz found this video of Donald Trump saying he liked Nancy Pelosi in 2006, and that's going to be it for him. I mean, this is a fundamental misreading of the Donald Trump electorate and a great part of the Republican base, because it's about attitude. So what you saw there, I think, really encapsulates it. Because first of all, Jeb Bush, I mean, the irony of someone who clearly, and maybe it speaks well of him on a personal level, clearly shrinks away and can't deal with any type of kind of direct interpersonal conflict. Right. And then on the other hand, he's saying, I'm going to be the president that's going to sort of escalate another kind of global war scheme like my brother in this disastrous hawkish fashion. Donald Trump is saying your brother lied about WMDs. He's a loser. That's the subtext. And what people don't get is that for the Trump voter, that is not going to be a problem, because he said it in the way of a winner. And I think that's the big sort of subtext that the media still doesn't quite seem to understand.
You know what? It's I don't know if they don't understand it as much as they can't do anything with it, right? You saw it in the debate when he was talking about the situation. He was really condemning some of the neoliberal economic policies of the Republican Party, and the crowd really didn't know how to respond because they know what he was saying resonates with that working class Republican.
Right.
And if they booed him on that point, then they would have been alienating that base. So I think they're stuck between a rock and a hard place where they don't really know what to do with Donald Trump on certain issues. And on other issues, they just can't even play ball. They just have to boo him. They have to try to destroy him by any means that they can. So I think they understand that they're in quite a quagmire, to be honest with you. They can't afford to lose that working class base that is angry, that identifies with Donald Trump. But everything that the Rockefeller Republican, the establishment Republican stands for is quite antithetical to that base. And Donald Trump has come in at the precisely correct moment to expose this gaping weakness that they have always had. And I don't know that there's anything at all that the establishment can do about it.
Yeah, I mean, it seems that what's very really striking too is that for all of the sort of effort to say that Donald Trump's xenophobia and bigotry and disgusting things he said about Muslims and Mexicans and women, like that doesn't represent us, that's a lot less convincing than now them being like, how dare you speak correctly and honestly about George W. Bush, right? That's exactly. When you've really gone too far. Because, I mean, I wouldn't put it like that, but of course Mexicans are rapists. Or as Jeb Bush did in the beginning, he said, oh, no, I don't like Asian immigrants. I'm a little bit nicer to the Mexicans, but Asians, they're the ones, you know, flying from Hong Kong to, like, have, you know, secret births here or whatever. But really with this the honest assessment of the Iraq legacy has sort of offended them more. And it is kind of mind-blowing that the most kind of ruthless description of George W. Bush's legacy. Also, I mean, and I'll ape Jeb Bush. Here's the deal. I'm tired of people exploiting 9/11, but I will say as someone who is, you know, a New Yorker now and has my family's from New York and there's some personal connection to it, it is offensive on some level and a total distortion of history that all Republicans treat the World Trade Center as just George W. Bush's mulligan. You know, Donald Trump isn't just making a debate point there. People say George Bush made us safe is
exactly.
A radical distortion of his security legacy and offensive to the reality and the legacy of the September 11 terrorist attacks. So I want to move off of, though, from that sort of hilarity to the Democratic race. And you have really interesting perspective on this. I know that, you know, sort of, I get best practices up front. You're a very strong Bernie Sanders supporter. And I kind of want to get, you know, we're moving into South Carolina. And these conversations are very awkward for a number of reasons. Because on one hand, it's important, obviously, to discuss and assess what candidate is going to be strongest on, you know, issues relating specifically to African Americans, issues relating specifically to the Hispanic community, to the, you know, to gay, lesbian, transgender community, everything else. And then the flip side of it is that, you know, there's this very kind of operationalized, like the Clinton people are saying, yeah, we're going into South Carolina and the black people are going to protect us. So my question is that, you know, what has been your process to sort of coming to Sanders as a black voter? And what about the notion of that firewall for the Clintons, why that's problematic and maybe not accurate?
You know, I think you putting the best practices up front, disclaimer, saying that I am a very strong Bernie Sanders supporter, really encapsulates my entire thinking on this, right? You have in South Carolina and across the nation, you have media elites, you know, the media establishment, which exists, right? We're not conspiracy theorists. There is a media establishment that wants access to power. And there is a black media establishment that wants access to power. The thing that pisses me off about them is that both black and non-black media elites, is that they try to go underneath the guise of being unbiased, as if they don't have a favorite. Yet they write all of these hit pieces and they do all these little drops on Twitter and they do all these little hits on MSNBC, which are clearly biased. And instead of coming out and saying, I am a firm supporter of Hillary Clinton and here are her policies and this is why I support her, they try to go underneath the guise of, I'm just doing journalism. No, the hell you're not. Absolutely not. And neither am I at this point. I'm doing advocacy for policies that I believe in and Bernie Sanders stands for. And that's why I'm fighting so hard for him. Mm. And I wish that other people in media would just be candid, just be clear. And what's happening with the black vote is you have a lot of people who control platforms that have tremendous reach, who are trying to speak on behalf of all black people and say that we are Hillary Clinton loves us and we love Hillary Clinton. The hell? Who loves Hillary Clinton? You know, just because you're trying to report that, you write articles about it, you tweet about it, you go on MSNBC and you try to make it a reality, that's not the case. And then to try to put us up as a firewall to protect her from, I mean, it's like, if Hillary Clinton can't get support from non-black voters, why the hell should it be black voters protecting her when she has a jaded history at best with African Americans, right? Let's not go into any detail about the negative things that we can pull up from her past. Let's just say she has a very jaded history at best. And when you come from that perspective, you realize that a lot of the media and political elite, particularly the black ones, are doing a disservice to the black community because in their efforts to appear unbiased, yet fuel rhetoric and put out rhetoric that is very supportive of Hillary Clinton and very divisive and attacking Bernie Sanders, they are not allowing us to have a fair and balanced conversation about the differences between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. And because of that, I think more people need to come out and say, you know what, to hell with this, to hell with all the form and fashion. I am a supporter of this person or that person. Here is why. Here's what she stands for. Here's what Bernie Sanders stands for. And I think we don't have that kind of honest discourse in our media right now. But there is no firewall other than the fact that Hillary Clinton has name recognition and Bernie Sanders, nobody really knows who this guy is. And there's a very nefarious game being played where they're trying to cast Bernie Sanders as this old white man who has a minority problem. And here is Hillary Clinton, who is going to be the savior of the black people.
Yeah, I mean, and that, and we could talk about why that's so problematic on a number of fronts. But I guess the other thing that's interesting about it is that, to me, when you look at the numbers, generally speaking, with African American and Hispanic voters, it tracks with the dynamics of this race for everybody, mm-hmm. which is that basically mm-hmm. young people support Bernie Sanders overwhelmingly. Mm-hmm. And then people, and that's true. I saw a poll the other day, and, you know, I forget who conducted it, but it was a legitimate poll. And the stat was that I think amongst African American voters under 30 or under 35 in South Carolina, Bernie Sanders had a 100% score on trustworthiness. That's an astonishing number. And I think so there's some aspects in which there isn't really a distinct story here.
Right.
So I guess the question then is it also the concern that this represents a disruption of leadership? Like, you know, we're the Congressional mm-hmm. Black Caucus. We are sort of, we endorse, we take the lead. Why aren't younger people listening to us in the same way that labor unions might be concerned, that more independent unions, in the same way that frankly, the larger Democratic establishment just thought, obviously, everybody's going to line up beside, you know, behind Hillary because that's just what everybody's going to do. And so that there's a threat of, you know, people's positions, frankly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it should be, right? I think people have to understand that you have your time and you have your season. And the Democratic establishment as we know it, or as we knew it, has morphed into this entity that is very antithetical to what it is to be a young progressive. Or a genuine progressive, no matter what age group you're in, right? You have some older progressives who are just as vigilant as a younger progressive. And you see that the Democratic establishment has become the inside party. They are just as detrimental to grassroots movements as the Republican Party. Instead of letting someone come from the ground up, they're trying to force a candidate. And they have done this for the last two election cycles. 2008, they did this with Barack Obama. He just had a better organization. They're trying to force it from the top down instead of allowing it to come from the ground up, yet they still want to capitalize on the votes. They want this grassroots populist image, and so that they can keep that progressive movement inside of their caucus, but they're doing things that are not grassroots, that are not progressive, and so you're seeing it break down along age, because a lot of younger people, we're still young enough to not be jaded and not to just give in to the powers that be, and we're young enough not to actually have been accepted into the establishment. If they were smart as they think they were, they would have co-opted, and I'm using the exact language, they would have co-opted as many young people as they possibly could have, so that they would be inside of the establishment. But because they were so fearful of their positions, they keep young people at bay, and we have no reason to cater to them because there's nothing in it for us.
Right. You know, the aspect of this race and that I want you to comment on, and I've noticed a lot in your commentaries, is that you are really making a very strong effort, and I would say along the lines of people like Adolf Reed and others, to really sort of merge the class conversation with the race conversation. Yeah. And I think that to cue this question up for you, what's fascinating to me is that people critique Bernie Sanders, sometimes correctly, for not speaking with a certain fluidity on race and gender issues as separate from class. But it strikes me that there's a pre-critique and a post-critique. And the pre-critique is some people don't want to talk about class at all. And they're just saying, well, why aren't, you know, you don't have, you're not mentioning race in the right way. Your language is not up to spec. There's then a deeper critique, which is that, you know, you're not quite understanding the way class interacts with all these other dynamics, and you need to more sort of fully flesh out your understanding. That's a post-critique, if that makes sense, in the sense that that's a critique that happens after class has already been fully integrated into the conversation. And that's something I want you to comment on, because you're speaking from the perspective of that before we can even sharpen the critique on anybody's record on civil rights issues, as an example, we need to understand the reality of class and all of these dynamics, which is, you know, we're not dealing with gender, we're not dealing with race in any type of real robust way in this country. But a big reason why we're not doing that is because class is not even rhetorically on the radar until a Sanders candidacy.
Right. We have, you know, goodness, this has only been happening since 2010 with Occupy Wall Street, right? We're just now beginning this conversation about income inequality and wealth disparities in America. And now we're seeing somewhat the culmination, hopefully just the genesis, rather, of this movement with Bernie Sanders. We cannot effectively address problems of race until we address the class structure around it, for which racism was always a tool, right? I try to tell people this all the time. They did not bring Africans from Africa, from West Africa, just because they didn't like us. They brought us over here because they needed to fuel an economic system with the cheapest labor possible. Right. Jim Crow was not just a system because they didn't like us. They needed to sustain as much as they possibly could in this transition period from slavery to the Industrial Revolution, as much as they possibly could, cheap labor or the extraction of wealth, sharecropping, just getting your entire life's labor along with your entire life capital. And that's what racism has always been a tool to accomplish, to keep poor white people from ever realizing that they have quite a bit in solidarity with poor black people. But so long as they feel as though minorities were the problem, then they would never look at the power structure around it, which was economically plundering poor white people, just like it was economically plundering poor black people. African Americans had the added injury and insult and pain and agony of racism and terrorism and death that was surrounding it. Now, you know, that's why we can't belittle the race component. But at the same time, we have to understand the reason that racism was there.
Right. And we need to think holistically. I mean, it was fascinating that this meme that was jumped up on one of the things that the Clinton campaign has deployed against Sanders is that he's a single issue candidate. And I said, no, he's not. He's a structural candidate, not a single issue candidate. And that's a big distinction. Mm-hmm. I mean, a single issue candidate is, you know, here's this one thing that I'm running on and I'm going to go on and on and on about it. When Lawrence Lessig, Matt makes the point. That's a perfect example. He said campaign finance reform is the one defining issue. You got money out of politics. Everything else takes care of itself. What Bernie Sanders is saying is that any issue set you look at, it's a question of structural impediments, whether it's money, whether it's the inside or outside game, whether it's structural inequality. And that cuts across all of these issues we're talking about. And it frustrates people, sometimes I think rightly, but sometimes wrongly, that he always brings that dimension into it because it does cut across everything. You cannot have the systemic police abuse you have, obviously without profound racism, but also the structural variables, which are class-based, that allow it that to exist as well. And that's not a single issue, that's structural. And that's actually thinking in a holistic and strategic way, which he should get more credit for.
You know, and I think Sanders needs to communicate that a little bit better, right? Mm-hmm. So you just put it in some succinct terms that if people were genuinely trying to hear, they would grab onto. I think Sanders could benefit from better messaging.
Available.
He's doing it. Yeah, exactly. He's doing quite well on staying on task in terms of subject. But it really is what you just said is so key. The structure around this entire system, that is what exacerbates racism. That is what, I mean, there is a reason that it operates the way that it does. And if we don't address it from a class angle as well, right, it's not an either or, and that's how ridiculous we have come to this in this election cycle. They're trying to make it, it's an either or. Either you're going to talk about race or you're going to talk about class. That is the most disingenuous assessment of reality that I've ever seen. Yes. And I see it promoted by a woman running for president. And I see it promoted by people in power politically and media wise. They are in positions where they can actually craft a conversation that would be beneficial to their constituency, yet they would rather play this disingenuous game of either or when it's clearly both and.
Absolutely. As a final thought, I'm moving forward. I mean, how, you know, I guess without the sort of generic prediction about South Carolina, but you have a large audience amongst these younger African Americans, younger progressives. I mean, I guess the deeper question is that there, beyond whether or not this primary turns out one way or another, do you think that, you know, in a sense, we've already sort of crossed the Rubicon with this candidacy, the tremendous win in New Hampshire, and the fact that this isn't about, you know, as distinct from, you know, Barack Obama, Iraq was the key policy issue. And then there was also just the notion that this really is something fresh. This is a guy who has a different type of leadership. There's obviously the historical nature of his candidacy. There's obviously a historical nature to Hillary Clinton's candidacy. But with Sanders, it's very, very, and, you know, people love the guy, but it is policy focused. And do you see people sort of integrating that this is something for the long haul? This might mean everything from I'm going to run for city council to, you know, how can I build something outside, you know, around the Benjamin Dixon show or the Majority Report that deals with any number of these issues in the structural way we've been talking about?
You know, what we're doing over at the Progressive Army, progressivearmy.com, is we're interviewing dozens of people who identify as Bernie Sanders Democrats. And the key thing about this is that it's not so much about Bernie Sanders as much as it is the distinction between a traditional Democrat, or traditional in the last 35 years, right? And a progressive Democrat. Because let's say this doesn't turn out the way we want. We will hold Hillary. Hillary Clinton winning to me is the same as a conservative winning to me, because it means I have to speak truth to power against someone who doesn't represent my full political ideology and leanings. So I would be able to speak out against Hillary Clinton's more conservative policies just as much as I would against a President Trump. So it doesn't stop if we don't win this primary. Hell, we might help, you know, some progressives might get in line and help Hillary get the White House. But that does not mean we're going to just go along with everything she says. Progress, this, we have crossed that threshold, like you said. We crossed the Rubicon. We've gone past the point of no return where we have finally gotten a glimpse of what America really should be, that we should not have just the opposite side of the same coin with our political parties. We should honestly have a disagreement in ideologies and beliefs and political and economic platforms and then battle it out. But for the longest, we've had two sides of the same coin where there are just little shades of difference between the two parties. And we're not really going back to that. I don't see us returning to that. I see the progressive movement growing and building and just fueling fire. No matter who wins, this movement will continue. And whoever gets the White House, even if it's Sanders getting the White House, he's going to have to address progressive issues. And that's the way it should be.
Benjamin, I agree with you 100%, and I appreciate your time. That's the Benjamin Dixon Show. There's links to it on our website. Benjamin, really appreciate your time. I'll talk to you soon.
Hey, thanks so much for having me, man.
All right, bye-bye. Okay, everybody. Hold on one second. Excuse me. We are going to go to the fun half, where I admit to you, I have a little bit of a Sam-style fun half planned. We're going to be talking about the sort of fraudulent intellectual legacy of Antonin Scalia. We're going to talk about the ceasefire that was announced in Syria and Munich. We're going to talk about Turkey ramping up military operations in Syria. So fun stuff. But we will also take your phone calls at 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. If you want to join the program, become a member of the Majority Report today, majority.fm/become a member. That's what allows all of this to happen. Write us a review on iTunes. That helps us. Subscribe to us on iTunes. Even if you're a member, it will not affect your member's feed. It will only help us climb the rankings. JustCoffee.coop. Get the Majority Report blend. Go to Majority Report Kickback. And you can either use our Jet.com link, which is, of course, the new socially responsible Amazon. I think it's 15% off of your first purchase. If it comes from through the Majority Report portal, majorityreportkickback.com, or if you're still using Amazon, you can use our Amazon link as well. Follow us on Twitter at majority.fm. Follow us on Facebook at The Majority Report on Facebook. We're posting a lot of content there now and embedding a lot of YouTube videos, and you can subscribe to our YouTube channel at YouTube/Sam Cedar. We will see you on the fun half. Remember, no show tomorrow, two shows today, this program and Sam's in-depth conversation on the situation with the death of Scalia with Ian Millhiser of Think Progress. See you on the fun half.